Hi, welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gammel from Chris Gammel's Analog Life.
How you doing, Chris?
Pretty good, Dave. How are you?
Good. You're back from the Open Source Hardware Summit and the, you didn't make it to the Maker Fair, did you?
No, I didn't make it there. Didn't make it there to the Maker Fair, but I...
Bummer. Yes.
Yeah, I've been watching pictures. They've been pretty intense. Have you been checking those out?
I heard it was pretty good. I haven't seen any photos or anything like that, but I've been getting some tweets from people I follow, and they say it's awesome, and, everyone should have gone, and we missed it.
blah, blah,
rub it in. I live in Australia. God. Well,
you're
may as well live in Antarctica.
You're going to set up your own eventually, right?
Oh, yeah, right. And we'll have 20 people show up.
Hey, man,
that'll be fantastic.
Better than nothing, right?
Oh, true, yeah.
Yeah, I was talking to one of the guys from Make, and he said those are pretty big. I mean, like, there's a lot more of them than there used to be, the mini Maker Fairs. And they are a smaller affair, but, you know, they're still worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, you got to remember, I mean, it's that, who's the group behind Maker? The Penton Publishing group.
No, not Penton.
Isn't it?
No, it's O'Reilly.
Isn't it Penton? Oh, no. Who is it?
O'Reilly.
O'Reilly, that's it. Yeah, some huge publishing conglomerate is behind Make, so, you know, that's how they can get these things.
Yeah.
I think they've got a lot of money to throw at them. And
I think Penton is EDN. I think
EDN, that's it. Yes, Penton. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Shadow corporations.
Yeah, exactly. Evil empires. Yeah. One world government, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, conspiracies.
Absolutely. So, tell us all about it, because it was,
it was great. I'm kind of in the midst of writing about it a little bit. I thought I was going to be writing a lot more about it, but it's kind of like, if I didn't just, the videos are all going to be up. So I saw so many people recording video, but I haven't actually seen them all yet. You know, there's a couple, there's one on Adafruit, and there's a couple others out there, and there's the Ustream stuff, but you know how that is. I mean, your site. You've seen that where the
Ustream is shit. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. It's almost not worth watching. No. Yeah, I just uploaded my latest Ustream live show, 1.5 hours, and it's just me doing like animated movements at 2 frames per second. It's just awful. Oh,
yeah, you don't want to watch that.
Ustream sucks.
I'm kind of waiting on the other stuff, and but you know, it was great. I mean, like the coolest part was just like seeing everybody in one room, even, you know, like. Or you know what the best part was? My favorite part, and I think I started to write about this last night. It's like, so they ask about, you know, who here does, you know, because a lot of the hobbyists is a lot of software people that want to get into hardware, which is good. But they asked everybody to raise your hand if you're a hardware designer, or even if anything like that, right? And the number of people in that room, there's probably about 300 people in that room, and about 150, at least half of the people were raising their hand. And I've never had that before, you know, like. Not like there's no hardware designers in the world, but just that's a lot of people, you know, like that's a lot of people that care about electronics.
I was a bit surprised when you said 150. I was expecting, oh, here we go. There'll be 10 people raising their hand and they'll all be software nerds. Oh, right. Okay. So they were surprised, were they?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was, it seemed like, and I think they also asked about engineering by training, like double E by training maybe. And So it was pretty cool. I mean, like, great crowd. I mean, got to meet some people from Make, got to meet one of the guys from MakerBot. You know, just really nice people and really inspiring, too. You know, you talk to them about their stuff they're doing. It's just like, wow, really? You're doing that? Like, it's cool. You know, you just love, you know, kind of shooting the shit with people about what they're working on.
Yeah, of course.
And that's usually the best part. So,
yep. Except then when they're working on much cooler shit than you, and then you feel a bit depressed, you know, because they're working on really cool stuff.
Well, yeah, you know, I like what I'm doing, but yeah, it's there's some cool stuff out there, and it inspires you at the very least. So, hopefully, we'll get some links up to the videos. I don't know. I have a couple things I wanted to mention about. I mean, I went to ESC Boston too, and that was pretty good. You know, I get to like meet Jack Gansel. That was really cool. He writes on embedded.com and he's been writing for a long time. So I got to meet him and talk to him a little bit, and he's a real nice guy too.
And excellent.
That was a good experience too, but it was like really different because, you know, one is really vendor sponsored and they're pushing, not pushing products, but, you know, they're definitely showcasing new products, and even the sessions are somewhat geared towards products and stuff like that. So I liked it, and it was a good experience. You know, I got to learn some stuff about some embedded software stuff. But I went to it to cover it for E-Times, which is nice. But I'm not as much embedded guy, so it was, you know, it was cool. But I dug the other thing a lot more.
Yeah, well, you talk about those vendor sponsored events. I mean, that's what I'm going to in October. In less than 2 weeks, I'm going to a vendor, a vendor specific event. So it's not just the generic public. It's you've got to be a specific fan of that particular company's stuff before you actually go. So that'll be a more niche market even again. So
And I mean, there are some benefits to that, because if you're working on a specific processor or a specific part and you really want to know and get deep and learn about that part, it's really nice to have, actually, because you're going to run into some experts on that stuff.
Exactly. And you're only going to run into experts, and the only exhibitors there are ones who actually have tools and stuff for this thing you're interested in. So
that's very true.
So I've been to one of those before. They actually had one here in Sydney once, but you know, I just went because it was a free day off work, really. I wasn't too concerned about the company's products and things like that. But I was surprised at the number of people there who turned up for this manufacturer's, they're flogging their 8-bit micros, and everyone turned up. So it was rather interesting, actually.
Yeah, there's kind of a continuum of like sessions and stuff that you can learn from. Like there's some very targeted vendor-specific one. Like, I went to a power seminar a couple of weeks back, and that was by a company, but it was actually very technically based. And so that was more school, but it was...
Well, that's exactly like the one I'm going to, which has like 50 different technical classes or something you can take. They're all running concurrently, and, just the number, the sheer diversity and the number of classes you can take during this 4-day conference thing is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and that's good too. I mean, and then there's the other side of it too, you know, where there's sometimes like distributors will have their own tech days, which are nice too, because you'll usually have vendor reps come in, but sometimes that's also just free lunch. I mean, like, to be honest,
it's free lunch and sales and a free tool. That's usually the
other end of the spectrum.
Programmer or something.
Yeah.
But they're really big in the US. Getting those in Australia is a big deal because they don't come here that often. So, if something's on here, I'll generally go to it. But,
so you guys, like,
I know some of them are just
lunch,
sales wanks. Free lunch. Well, we get free lunch at work anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Oh, wow.
So there
that's
you go.
Nice.
That's one of the perks, free lunch.
That's good.
Mm.
Well, the open hardware, though, it was cool because there was a couple of keynotes, and one of them was like... was Lamour Fried, who's part of she's Lady Ada from Adafruit, and they actually posted her talk on Adafruit.com on their blog.
I've seen that. I haven't watched it yet. I've only watched the Arduino one. They've also posted that, the video of the Arduino, the whole Arduino team's there, and they talk about the history and the new change which is coming up, which we might talk about, and things like that. Yeah. So that was very interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, her talk is, it's really good, and it's really personal too, you know, like talking about how she's kind of come up through doing all this stuff, and just for all the people that shun away from swearing, even though you do listen to Dave, there is a little swearing in there, and it's a little harsher than Dave sometimes. So just keep that in mind. Just thought I'd throw that
in. Excellent. Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
So, it's rated PG, is it? Or something?
PG-13 or something,
PG-13 plus or something, yep.
But that was a good talk. And then who else is on there? You know, there's some other talks that I didn't think would be very interesting, but actually turned out to be quite interesting. One of the lawyers from... the Creative Commons was there, and he does science coverage for Creative Commons licensing. And I thought, you know, that kind of thing is going to be really boring, but it actually was. It was really good. Who was it? It was John Wilbanks, and he's a great speaker in the first place. But just learning about all that stuff and how
that helps,
And you know, you and I have talked about that before with patents and how that's kind of a big area of strife. But not only that. Patents exist, and they are a tool, and they can be an impediment. But also, even if you want to ignore them completely, they're still going to affect you, because even if you try and license it and open everything up, you might not be able to do that. And that there's like a legitimate worry about that. So say, you do a new design, Dave, and you say, okay, I'm going to open source this, but I also want...
Somebody's squatting a patent.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So bastards.
There's some legitimate like licensing concerns there, and it's interesting. You know, I didn't think I was going to like that at all, but that was actually one of my favorite talks. So
right,
I look forward to hearing that.
A lawyer, evil lawyer. Who would have thought?
Well, he's an evil lawyer, but he's an evil lawyer with a technical background. So he is,
and
acceptable.
He's actually working on the good side too, right? So
that's right. Yeah,
he's working on the open hardware
side. He's not
side.
Fighting.
He's
for
not
money
a
for
patent
patents.
Lawyer. That's right.
Right. Right.
Yes.
And then there's some other good ones too, like the panels. So you know, some big names are on there, like Chris Anderson and Peter Semmelhack from Bug Labs and Phil Terone from Adafruit as well. And
yeah.
Actually, even Massimo Bonzi was on there too. So it was cool. You know, interesting. You know, kind of hearing about the business side of it and how they actually still make money. But you know, it's still all about like, oh well, it's all open source. But there's always kind of this interesting like undertone of, well, we're still making money on this though. You know what I mean? Like,
no, of course, yeah, like, yeah.
Like one of your kits is open source. Didn't you have a kit that's open source or?
Well, I've open sourced my watch. I've open sourced the software. I haven't open sourced the hardware yet because I haven't been bothered. But, well, the information's up there. You know, you can just go and have the schematic. I haven't released the PCB files yet. But, you know, I'll send them to people if they want them. It's, you know, so it's effectively open.
Yeah.
All of my projects are effectively open because I've had them published in the magazine, which is before all this open source hardware came along. That's how you opened your project, was to publish it publish it in Silicon Chip or something like that. So
yeah, and that's actually a really interesting point that John Wilbanks, that Creative Commons guy, talked about, is that the best defense for the future is to publish everything. Is to, like,
absolutely.
Because if, I mean, you've done that before, but not even that, but like even if you have an idea, right? And say tomorrow you want to have, you know, a hat that tweets the weather, you know, some silly device that someone might want to patent someday. The best defense is to publish your idea now. And even if so, and if everything was published right now, if somehow we could publish everything simultaneously of every idea that's ever done in the future, then in 17 years, when every patent has run out, then there would be no more possible, because it would be in the prior art database. No one would be able to get it anymore. And boom, everything's open then.
Well, but it still wouldn't stop them, because it's a matter of finding prior art, which is one of the arts of patenting and defending patents and things like that. So, you can't just tweet it or something like that, maybe, because you'll never find it again. But if you publish it on your site that's viewed by, you know, 10,000 geeks a month and indexed on Google for that specific search term, then, you know, it's much better.
He was actually advocating putting it into the prior art database. So however that's done.
Oh, there is a prior art database. Oh, right. There you go. That's news to me.
Right. And
there
so I mean, his talk was great. I mean, hopefully that'll be up soon. And you know, there was just so many great talks and people, and I don't know. Mm. It was really cool. Even just
rub it in.
Yeah, sorry. So how's stuff out in Australia, Dave?
Well, you know, it's all happening out here. I interviewed myself. That was fantastic.
Hey, look at me.
I'm over here in Australia. Anyone heard of Australia? Oh god. Rub it in. But no, that's fantastic. I love the I love the fact that you can go to stuff like that when you're you know, in the US. They have those things. Seems like every month there's something really cool like that happening over there. So
I'm really hoping they're having it again. I talked to Dale Doherty, who's the founder of Make. I got to meet him, actually, and he's a really nice guy. And I asked him, and I'm like, are you going to have this, you know, is this going to happen again? And he's like, he actually pointed out that this wasn't put, the Open Hardware Summit wasn't put on by Make. It was actually mostly hosted by Bug Labs.
There you go.
And also Little Bits. No, sorry. The people who set it up were Alicia Gibb and Aya Bedir. And so they were setting everything up. And so they were basically the ones who got all the big funding. Like Bug Labs, I think, was the main sponsor. So hopefully they'll do it again next year. And maybe you can come out for that.
Possibly. That would be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to just do a trip over there and, you know, actually tee up a couple of these events and stuff like that if the wife lets me go. And
right.
Yeah, but it's all about the money, you know. It cost me thousands of dollars. Right. Maybe I can get someone to sponsor to send me back. So
right. Well, who knows? Actually had Bunny Huang from Chumbi. He was actually up on Skype the whole time. So they had a video of him up there. So, I mean, awesome. Very least you could do that.
Yep. I don't know if anyone's going to be interested to see me in 2 frames per second up on Skype on the big screen, are they?
Yeah, well, it would be better than Ustream. It'd be Skype. So that video is not too bad, but it's...
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So it was good. All around good.
It was excellent. Excellent. Well, I was really stunned by the number of hardware people there. We probably should talk about that. I mean, I expected them to be all software-focused people who just dabbled in a bit of hardware. But from what you're saying, it seems like, you know, a good half of them were, actual hardware engineers or did hardware for a living or...
You know, I'm trying to think back to it now. I hope I didn't misspeak. I think the thing that everybody raised their hands at was... Actually, the engineer question. So, who had a formal engineering training? So, that actually might have been thrown off. Now, if you're a CS kind of major, then I don't think you'd raise your hand, but maybe you would. I don't know how that counts.
Well,
but...
maybe, yeah, because they might have an inferiority complex because they're at a hardware conference. Oh, yeah, I've done my computer science degree. That's got to count, right? So, they raise their hand. And
but I still think that in terms of, I think there was more there, and from the ones I talked to, at least, most people that I talked to were doing some kind of hardware. In some capacity. Right. That's not a great sample size because I didn't talk to everyone. But
Well, it is the Open Source Hardware Summit, so right, I guess it's not surprising, right? It's not an open source software summit, so yeah, I guess it's not
And I mean, even if
surprising
you're,
when you think about it.
Yeah, even if you are a software person at your day job kind of thing, but you go home and you work on, you know, an Arduino shield at night, I would call myself a hardware person at that point, you know? I think
of course.
Totally
yeah, if you've laid out a board and etched a board, you're a hardware person.
Oh, definitely.
You know, that's,
welcome
that's,
to the brotherhood.
That's pretty much it. That's right.
Or sisterhood, whatever. And actually, that was another interesting thing, too. That was
Do tell about the ratio.
Well, it was at the beginning, but it was like the two hosts were female, and then Lamore stepped up on stage, and then so Aya, who's one of the main, she was the main host, she steps up. She's like, I just want to mention 3/4 of the people that have been on stage so far have been female.
Right.
Which is awesome. And it was a great point. And, you know, and there were, you know, in terms of like what I view as, you know, at least my exposure to, you know, engineers in workplaces, it seemed like a much higher percentage. And hell yeah.
Absolutely.
That's great. You know, and
yeah, why not?
I think that the you know, tying in the Make Your Fair kind of stuff, it's just a much broader appeal, and the fact that these people are working on hardware also, I think in terms of ways to encourage women to get into engineering, like practical applications like the, like Maker Faire stuff, that is the way to do it, you know?
That draws them in because subtly it draws them in because it might start out being arts and crafty kind of maker stuff, and then they go, oh, I can add LEDs to my little thing, can I? What's this microcontroller thing?
Right.
Ooh, you know,
and it goes both ways too, and because they gave us a free copy of Craft magazine, which I had never read before,
right?
And that goes the other way, where you're starting to do like LED lampshades and all this stuff, and like awesome stuff. Like, I'm like, oh man, this is what I want my house to look like, you know? Like, so
yeah, well, I've thought about that too. I've thought about doing, you know, some sort of weird electronic sculptory art or something that, you know. I've never gone ahead and done it, but you know, it's maybe something that if I had enough free time, I would have a go at, I think. So
yeah,
I would suck at it, but you know, I'd have a go.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting, and it kind of leads into what I wanted to talk about next was, you know, did you hear about Nokia at all? Did you read that article?
I read the thing about Nokia, and they've got a new CEO who is just I won't say he's a douche, but he's just a manager guy. You know, right. he's not a. I think he might. I don't know. Is he an engineer? I don't know, but he's certainly not.
MBA style more than engineer style.
MBA style engineer, yeah. Right. So he's never actually designed anything, but I'm sure he manages companies really well, you know.
But
the story is, the gist of the story is, yeah. We'll have to put up a link for it, but yeah. It was basically that's what they don't need someone who can manage the company, because Nokia has been a perfectly managed company from day one, I think. You know, there's no problem. Their problem lies in their products and
right.
the actual development, and how to compete with Apple and all that sort of stuff.
Right,
you know, everyone's beating them nowadays, you know.
Right.
Apple, Samsung, and God knows who else, and HTC, and everyone, basically.
Yeah, I'm always amazed when I see the percentage of the market that they still have. Like, Nokia worldwide is still pretty high. But it's dropping off a cliff, I think. So
and they know it's very they're right on the edge of the cliff, and they know it, because you know, everyone's my last phone was a Nokia because I've always used a Nokia, so I just got another Nokia, really, you know, and it seemed to be the right, you know,
how do you say that?
Choice went into it, but sorry,
Nokia. That sounds like had that pasta, that potato based pasta. From
No.
Gnocchi?
So, yeah, that's in Australia, Gnocchi? It's Nokia. It's not Nokia.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Nokia.
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 Yeah.
Nokia, mate. Yeah, no worries, mate. Nokia.
All right, that's good.
This Nokia rubbish.
Yeah, yeah. Nokia. Well, what are the first two letters in there? It's no, right? That's the word no.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I don't know any Scandinavian people, so if I'm saying it wrong, I apologize but
you know. Yeah. Anyway, it's Nokia here.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That's how we pronounce it.
Mostly. Well, the interesting
question,
though,
I'm sure there's people.
Is so, you know, you look at the two companies, and obviously,
Apple and
are we talking about
Apple?
Apple and Nokia or Nokia. Or,
yeah.
You know, and
Nokia's fine. I can live with that.
Okay. And they're basically Nokia, or at least all the pundits are clamoring for an Apple kind of revolution, right? With, you know, Steve Jobs comes in and he fixes everything. He has a vision, and that's what they're saying, that this new guy is not. And well, what my question is, you know, we just spent 20 or so minutes talking about the awesomeness of open source, but Apple is the furthest thing from open source. You know,
absolutely, they're almost the evil, you know, the evil empire compared to open source.
They are the new Microsoft, right? There's a tweet about that a couple weeks back.
The original, you know, 1970s, 1980s, version of Microsoft, you know, who wanted to rule the world and only have their products and you know, fiercely defend it, and the way they push their ideas is the way the market should go.
And people are latching on now. Interesting side note, historical side note for people that did not attend the Open Hardware Summit, you might see it in videos. I have never seen so many Apple products at an Open Hardware Summit before. And granted, this is my first summit.
Really?
But the contrast was just really striking. I mean, these people that were attending obviously love good design. There's no doubt about that. But if you're at a Open Hardware Summit with an Apple device, something in my head screams irony, you know?
It does. Absolutely. That's fascinating.
I think part of it is just the culture of these people. A lot of them are craftsmen, you know, a lot of them make stuff and they probably appreciate good, you know, nice design.
They appreciate good design, and they curse. I'm sure every one of them will bitch about the non-openness of it and the proprietary nature and all that. You know, they'll bitch for hours about it, but they love good design. So can good design triumph over, you know, the pure open source ethos kind of thing? I don't know.
And so that's the question. I mean, like, is one person dictating from top down? Basically, it's top down versus bottom up. Top down being, you know, Steve Jobs says, it has to be like this. This is my vision. I've worked with these people, but it is my, you know, it eventually comes down to one person. Whereas bottom up is, you know, all these individual parties are developing separately. You know, I develop an open hardware board. Dave develops one. Whoever has more people following it, and eventually, you know, it's like an evolutionary type method where the best one wins.
Well, my response, I've said this before and I'll say it again, that I think the best products are designed by as fewer people as possible. One person, one genius, one idea, one vision, they produce the best products. I have no doubt about that. Open source is great, but does it produce a good a well-designed product? I don't think so. It produces a popular product, but okay. I wouldn't say well-designed. Typically, it tries to be a jack-of-all-trades, and it tries to satisfy a lot of people. It's just right. a natural, you know, there's too many hands in the pot, you know, too many chefs spoil the broth, as they say. And yeah, I'm a huge believer that one person should really, really, you know, one person is more than capable of, is better suited to produce a top quality product than a bunch of rabble. You know, really, I love the bunch of rabble. I love the open source hardware thing, but does it produce, you know, can it actually produce an iPhone? Well, you know, I don't think so. I mean, there's a Chumbi out there, which is pretty darn good, but ultimately, I think that's done by one or two guys at Chumbi. Right.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's
it's open hardware, but how many people actually contribute? Right. Very few.
Well, if you look at
how
other
many
stuff
people
too,
contribute like, to the Arduino? You know, right. there's not many. There's only a couple of people doing the Arduino.
Yeah, that's
and
a good point.
So on and so forth.
Yeah,
so,
and I mean, like even BeagleBoard. I think Gerald Coley was, you know, started it out.
Yep.
And I think he's the one who laid out the first one. And it's interesting because there is that initial push that it's got to start somewhere. You know, someone has to come up with this vision. So, yeah, it's interesting. Then you kind of let it go and put it through the ringer.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting to know, you know, everyone loves all this open source stuff. But I think it's a bit of a sham, really. I think people just love it because it's cool, right? They don't actually care that they can actually get the source code. I mean, the percentage of people who actually go and, you know, recompile the kernel for Linux or go and recompile the firmware for the Arduino or something like that is very few. The majority of people just want to use the product and they like it. Because it's open, because it's cool, and maybe one day they might be able to modify it, but very few people actually get around to actually doing that, I think. So
I wouldn't call it a sham, though, I don't think. No,
it's not a sham. That's probably the... But that's the illusion of open source, that, everybody's contributing, and, you know, everyone's modifying it themselves, where they're not. I think the majority of people just use the finished product, and that's it.
Well, that's true, I mean...
And it's the same with any open source, you know, I use a lot of open source software on my machine here, you know, open source stuff, but I don't ever want to download the source code. Who cares? I just want
you
the compiled
Linux.
Binary.
You love
you know?
Linux.
I hate Linux. Well, only because I'm so used to Windows. You know, I love the concept of Linux, and when it works, it's great. But yeah, I don't know how to compile it, and I don't care. I just want the finished binary, and I love its
and
open
that happens
source
sometimes.
Because
you know,
I know
happens
that
with a lot of stuff.
Well, the reason I love open source software on a PC is a bit of a tangent here, is that I know that many people have contributed, quite a few people have contributed to it, and that means many people have checked it, which means it's usually quite solid, and it's got no spyware built in, no, you know, weird hidden stuff and things like that.
Yeah.
So that's one of the good aspects of it, is there's a lot of people that have actually checked it to see that it's actually good, so... As opposed to just a commercial product, people use it and they, you know, you can't see what's under the hood. So,
right, yeah.
Yeah.
Not too many people checking out the iPhone schematic stuff, but...
Well, exactly. 20-layer
boards,
they don't care.
Or whatever
they
are.
Yeah. Yeah, they just use the finished product. And I hate to say it, same with the Arduino. Most people just use the finished product. I'm sure the Arduino team would actually agree with me that the majority of people who buy their boards just buy the finished Arduino. They buy the finished shield and they buy the, you know, which is fine.
And a lot of the times that's the point, because it's just getting off the ground quickly.
Point.
Yeah.
Exactly. You're building an open source product and people want to buy the product. And
So that's interesting. I mean, when you think about it like that with one person kind of starting it and then a branching to like a super user group and then, but I mean, like you said, that happens in software too. So,
But I don't think, you know, once it reaches a sort of a small mass of core people actually developing the product, it's not going to get any bigger than that. There's not going to, you know, it's not going to grow to 1,000 people contributing stuff to a product, you know, huge open source software projects. If you look at the list of core developers, there's only half a dozen or something.
Wikipedia pages are like that too, where you know,
it's
like following a power law kind of stuff, where the greatest contribute the fewest contributors are contributing the most work, basically, and it falls off very rapidly.
Exactly. It's a bell curve thing. Again, it's not everything in electronics.
No, it's not. It's a power law.
No, it's not.
No.
Oh, right. Okay, right.
So it falls off much quicker than a bell curve.
Yes, of course it will. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting, and we'll probably see more and more of this. I mean, another thing they brought up was, you know, encouraging companies to open up their designs. And
yep.
I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't know how many would. I mean, I think about commercial designs, you know, like if I'm doing contract work for a manufacturer, I'm not going to encourage them to open up their design if they're the only people making it. I mean, there are some situations where it's like, no, I don't think so. But if it became a development platform, you know, if I was working on a development platform, hell yeah, I'd tell people to open it up.
That's a different thing, you know. Yeah. Development platforms are different to products and so forth.
Yeah. So we'll see more of that in the future, I'm sure.
Absolutely. But yeah, it sounds like open source hardware's the go. And yeah. I think all of my future products will be open because I've always made them open, really. So I don't think there's one product I haven't, of my own personal project that I haven't made open, that I haven't published and made open in some way. Yeah. So I've been doing that for 20 years plus.
Man,
so
that's just another great segue right there. So let's talk about publishing some projects because we actually had a question.
That's right.
It was from someone on your forums, I think.
That's from last week, that's why.
Okay, so basically someone had
asked...
like, you know, and how a lot of sites out there are looking for content these days. Understandable. Yep. And they all want content. And they'll even pay you for it. But really, what is the best way to get your content out? And if so, say you're making a new Arduino project or a new BeagleBoard project or Bug Labs project, whatever it's going to be, how do you publish it? What's the best ways to do that?
Well, the best way to do it now with the internet is via the internet. I mean, it's the easiest way, okay? It may not be the best way. The best way is to get it published or get it at you can put it on your own blog, your own website, but how many people visit your own personal website, right? You know, you're not like my website and, you know, you get 100,000, 150,000 hits a month or something. There you go.
I'm so popular.
I am so popular, my blog. People just keep coming back. And, you know, but yeah, like an average small-time blog, you know, you might get, you know, 50 people a week or something, you know, so you really need to get it mentioned somewhere, but you can publish it there, start there, submit it to the other ones, maybe get on Hacked Gadgets or get on one of the other blogs, one of the more popular blogs or something like that.
Yeah.
But the traditional electronics magazines are still out there and they still accept submissions, Silicon Chip and Circuit Seller and all the rest of them.
Yeah, and a lot of them are paying these days. So
they do pay. Silicon Chip, if you don't know, is $100 Australian dollars per page, which isn't much. But if you do a 10-page article, there's $1,000.
Good Lord.
You know, so
I've never seen that magazine.
You haven't seen Silicon Chip?
No, I don't think I've ever read it.
Well, it is an Australian-specific one. It's the only remaining Australian electronics magazine.
So do they write with an accent?
But it is kind of... got to write with an accent.
It looks pretty normal.
well, it is pretty normal. Silicon Chip, there you go. Right. But yeah, that's one of the few electronics magazines left. There's probably three or four of them.
Yeah, this is nice. I like
and,
this.
And they all accept projects and they all pay for projects. So it really doesn't, you know, a lot of people over the years have asked me, you know, do I make money out of publishing my projects in the magazine? No, the amount of time you put into a good magazine project, you know, even if you're getting $1,000 for the article, I'm telling you, I would have spent a lot more than $1,000 in my time, to actually do it and write the article and buy the prototype.
Yeah, you do it for the exposure.
And
And you know, to be fair, you know, if you are publishing, you know, that is a way to get noticed if you're looking for a new job, if you're looking to connect with other
people. Absolutely.
That could be a great way to network. So, you know, always got to remind people about the human aspect of things. And, you know, people aren't going to know you're out there unless you show them. But
exactly.
That's not the only motivation.
As I've maybe said in one of my job search blogs, even before the internet, there was nothing better than turning up to a job interview and the person interviewing me goes, oh, you're Dave Jones. I've read your article. You know, it was great. And it's like, whoa, hello. You know, yeah, it's
taking
fantastic.
Out to lunch now.
Nothing, exactly. Nothing beats that. Yeah. I mean, you know, turning up and you already have a rep before you turn up to the interview. Nothing can beat that.
Right.
Seriously. Yeah. So, that's good. Yeah, if you've got a new design, publish it on your blog and try and get it published in the magazines as widely as possible. You know, there's quite a few ways to do it now. So it's
well, let's talk
whereas
about
back in the old days it was just the magazines.
What about self-publishing?
Self-publishing in what?
Just on like a website. I mean, because we say like publish it on a blog or something, but I mean, you and I both do that, but maybe people out there listening don't know how to do that, so maybe we
should go. Blogs are incredibly easy. You know, for $5 a month, you can get your entire web host like mine, and I host half a dozen different websites on there for, you know, you can get that for $5 a month, and WordPress is a single-click install, and it's just, you know, a single-click install for a wiki.
Yeah.
Oh, it's,
maybe
yeah,
we should slow it down a little
pretty
bit.
Pretty trivial.
So okay. Basically,
if you want HTML, right?
Right, so web hosting is... Yeah. If you are buying servers, basically a part of a hard drive and the associated processing on someone else's server. So it might be, you know, like bobshosting.com. And you're going to go there and you're going to log into his site, dump all your files there, probably through FTP. And then hopefully, like Dave said, they'll have like one-click installs. So that's a really great way to be able to publish your stuff. And then once you get a WordPress install, WordPress is what Dave and I both use. And actually the Amp Hour does as well. It's a open source blogging template, and they'll give you a bunch of free stuff. They'll, you know, commenting and picture uploading and all that stuff. You used to have to do that by hand. Dave, you've done that by hand, right?
Oh, yeah. I used to do all my old websites you see are all HTML coded by hand. Yeah.
Right. So you no longer have to do that. WordPress is all in PHP. There's other stuff out there. Actually, just today I saw Microsoft had a live blogging platform. And they just merged with WordPress.com today. So all of their blogging is going over to WordPress. So,
interesting. So the when you say Microsoft merged with somebody, that means they bought out WordPress, did they?
No, they didn't. Well, they probably did. Well, I'm guessing that I only just read the article.
Right.
There's two parts to WordPress. WordPress.org is the open source component where they...
Yep.
You know, they'll give you the software files, and that's basically their code repository and everything. And and that's where you go to get the actual software to make a WordPress blog. WordPress.com is actually a hosting site in itself. So you can go to WordPress.com, get Chris Gammel. You can get that one, but you can get Chris Gammel is awesome. WordPress.com, and that is going to be your own blog, which will be, you know, Chris Gammel is awesome. And then,
exactly, and it doesn't cost a cent either. It's free.
Yeah. So. And so the only difference there is you'll have the WordPress.wordpress.com in your title. But if you don't mind that and you just really just want to throw stuff up on the web, that's probably a pretty easy option, and it's free, like Dave said.
It's a very easy option, but I wouldn't recommend it. I would spend $5, buy a .com domain name, and set up your own one because it's trivial. You can literally set it up in 5 or 10 minutes, and it costs you... You know, even as little as $2 or $3 a month, I think you can get a really basic hosting package, and a .com domain is $5 a year or something.
Yeah, I think now you can actually even point .com names. So like, you know, eevblog.com, you can actually point that at WordPress.com servers. So it's still going to be hosted. I think it's still hosted on WordPress.com.
Right, but does it mask it? Because that's what I'm talking about. If you see the WordPress.com, it does. It masks it. Okay, well, there you go.
I think only because I think Cherish, the scientist.net, you know, our friend from there, I think she did that. Now, I'll have to double check on that, but I think you can finally point specific domains at the WordPress hosted blogs. So hopefully we didn't lose anyone, but
so the idea is, you know, get yourself a blog or something like that and put your information up, or even if it's just a HTML page or something like that is perfectly fine,
or just file somewhere. You can always
wiki
just do that
or something. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I recommend you get your own .com domain name, and it's pretty easy. So self-publish. It's easy. But then once again, people aren't going to find you in a hurry. It's all about the search terms and the specific. I won't go into search engine optimization, but you can check out that. But really, you've got to get mentioned somewhere after that, after you put it up. So
if that's your concern too, if you're just looking to publish for yourself, you just want to have your information up there as like a personal journal, even, that's okay. You know, if you want to have that as a record of what you've done, maybe for prior art, like we talked about earlier, that's okay too.
Yeah.
But like Dave said, unless people are finding you, you're probably, you know, like people aren't going to find you easy unless you start doing some work towards that. I'm not saying it's important, but if that's what you're interested in, don't expect big visits up front. That's the only thing to watch out for.
Absolutely. You really have to work towards that. But if you just put it up there and do nothing, people will eventually find you.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it's really, you know, it's a given that they will find you. yes, you can't escape Google, so.
Yeah, they're watching.
But yeah, by all means, self-publish everything. Put it up there. And then when you go to it, if you're, you know, you're young and you want to get a job in the industry, point them to your blog site and, you know, make it look not fully professional, but at least make it look respectable.
It's kind of like the new resume, you know. It's not necessarily just showing where you've worked, but also what you've done. Like Dave said, that is a really powerful thing, you know.
Massively.
I'm always impressed. Like whenever I see someone like a resume and stuff, you know, you could see what people have done sort of, but once you see, even if they've worked on a solar car team or something like that, or electronics at home, anything like that, that immediately jumps out to me as someone looking at resumes. I don't know about Dave or anybody else, but that's something that jumps out to me.
Yep. Absolutely.
And like Dave said, if you show them a circuit when you're actually there, that's even more impressive. So,
well, exactly. If you actually bring stuff along and show them your little widget you've designed or something like that, that's widgets. The best thing you can do. But yeah, definitely put in your webpage on there and say, hey, go check out my stuff I've designed. Yeah. And you're just going to be streets ahead of everyone else. Because literally when, you know, if I'm sorting through resumes, you know, I will literally, you know, I will do like a 5-second glance at each one and I'll toss them either, okay, that's worthy of a second look, or it goes straight in the bin, you know. And it's really, and I'll see, and generally the thing is, well, if they've got their own website, okay, that'll go in the site I'll check out, because I'll go check them out. It won't get binned, you know, whereas if you're just going, oh yeah, I worked at such and such and I did this, and it's like boring, it's filled with grammar and spelling mistakes, well, you instantly get tossed out,
right?
But if you show that, oh, you've done stuff, and there's extra info I can look at,
And it's definitely important, because a lot of times you can't even talk about everything that you've done at a job. You know, I can't talk about everything I've done at my job, but I can talk about everything I've done outside of work, because I do whatever the hell I want, you know?
Absolutely.
So that's where the real power comes in, too. You can show nitty-gritty details. I spent 20 hours troubleshooting this circuit, but I finally found that stupid wire that was stuck, and I found it, and now it's fixed, and that's it.
Exactly.
And they show it shows
and that's
you care.
A massive selling point, really. Yeah. When you're trying to sell yourself to someone, that is, there's nothing better.
Yep.
So,
students,
anyway,
beware.
We should get off that.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
Well, you want to talk about design then? Low power design, I think we wanted to have a little rant about, because you got stuck. Tell us about the lame ass digital recorder you got stuck with.
Yeah. Well, David had suggested that I, you know, look at Zoom H1, and then they're sold out everywhere. And basically, I had one apparently in the mail, and I just talked to him today, and, you know, apparently they found the packing slip, quote unquote, but there was no Zoom attached to it, so they said they were sending me one, but I'm going to get it somewhere else now. So anyways,
You bought it from Amazon, didn't you?
Yeah, it was like one of those side sellers on Amazon. You know how they do that stuff.
Oh, right. Okay. It was through Amazon, but a side seller, yep.
Yeah. That's shady.
I ordered
sometimes.
Mine from eBay, so mine's in the post, supposedly.
That's good, yeah. So I'm going to get one eventually, but... I ended up going out and buying a different one. And, you know, I looked online after the fact. I was rushing to get to this conference. And after the fact, I looked at the battery life. It says, 7.5 hours. And it's got like two double A's. So 3 volts at however
reasonable capacity.
Yeah. It was like, you know, a couple, there's like 1400 milliamp hours or something like that. Whatever a double A is. And
a double A is 2800.
Okay.
2800 milliamp hours.
That's a good number to remember.
There you go. For an alkaline, for a standard alkaline.
Right, yeah, and
so
that's what I was using.
That's a nominal figure, so.
Right, right. And so, you know, I looked online, it said 7.5 hours. I go record this thing, and it's 2 hours. I'm like, what?
Oh, that is shocking.
I know, and so I'm burning through batteries. I feel guilty about that. I'm burning through cash because buying batteries in Boston apparently is, you know,
right.
high margin enterprise, and yeah. So I'm switching over. It makes me wonder because I bought a device that was probably I'm not sure exactly when it was released. It was, I don't know if I should name and shame on here, but. You know,
absolutely.
It didn't look that old. It was a
if it's a Tascam, piece of shit, call it
Tascam DR07. You know, and I'm
Tascam,
like
Tascam, bunch of bastards.
DR07. Yeah, and they have a couple other
don't
ones.
Don't touch it, fellas.
I went the low end, and maybe that's my own fault for going low end. But
right.
You know, this other one I'm supposed to get is supposed to be 10 hours. So, you know, what are the components of low power that they're probably doing wrong? That's what I wanted to talk about. You know, the actual electronic side of it, because. That's what's important to this show.
and the Zoom to everyone at home, the Zoom H1 which we're getting that has this 10 hour battery life, and I'm sure it meets it because Zoom's a big company and they stand by they're the best in the industry or something. But it's 10 hours off a single AA, whereas the Tascam one, the DR07 is 2 AA's and only got 2 hours.
Right, so that means they're probably boosting it on the. On the Zoom, they're probably boosting it at least up to, you know, 2.5 or 3.3 or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sure that, yeah, they obviously have to be, but...
Yeah, well, there's losses associated with that, too. So, you know, a boost converter, you probably only get, like, 90% nominally, you know, on a best-case, fully loaded scenario.
Yep, and, absolutely.
So that's already a strike against them. So what the hell's going on here? That's, I mean, like, so...
Well, the Tascam one is just poorly designed, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
a heap of shit. Leakage currents were probably one thing that they, you know, they messed up on.
They just probably run the processor at full tilt or something. You know, they probably run to 8 megahertz when they don't need to or something like that. And they haven't optimized it. Has it got, like, a big LED? Has it got, like, a backlight on the display or something
that's
stupid like
one.
That?
Yeah, it's got
a
backlight.
Is it permanently on? Is it permanently on the backlight? Oh, well, there you go. You're pissing away current for the for the backlight LEDs there. What do you need that for?
Right. And I think, you know, and I even tested it. I thought at first, because it's got a wave record, and then which is native, you know, that's basically straight into an ADD. And then there was MP3 record, which is compressed. So I thought, I'll turn off the MP3 and just, you know, I have to unload the data off there more often. And nope, same thing.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the Zoom H1 is that I couldn't believe this when I read the spec. It's got a rated 10-hour battery life for recording direct to MP3.
Yeah.
Well, it isn't direct. It's got to go through an MP3 decoder, and we'll talk about that. But in the to actually store the WAV file, it's got a 9.5-hour battery life, which really floored
backwards.
Me. I thought, you know, I expected it to be double when you're recording WAV, because I'm not sure. Yeah. You know, if you go and look at how much effort's involved in encoding an MP3 file, it's actually a lot of work. You've got to get a dedicated, either you've got to do it in your micro, and it's got to be a real grunty one, or you've got to have a dedicated MP3 encoder chip to actually do it. And there's lots of software and algorithms involved, processing grunt to do real, you know, real-time MP3 encoding. Whereas a WAV file, as you said, is just recording directly from the microphone, pretty much straight onto the card. It doesn't really have to process
it. It's got attenuation to make sure you're not clipping into the ADD, and then you...
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's...
And then it's just basically ADD values. Dumb. It says, you know, at time zero, the value was 4 volts, and then time zero plus 0.001 is... 3.9, and then that
really
basically
dumb
traces
ass.
Out your waveform.
So
maybe
what I think's happening. Sorry,
no, go ahead. I'll hear yours first.
Well, what I think's happening in the Zoom H1 because they're so close. I think 9.5, 10 hours. I think what the difference there isn't a real difference. I think it's just that's just the error in the battery measurement in the actual measurement. I think they're running at exactly the same speed, really, and that's the thing. I think the processor they're just running the processor that's optimized for doing MP3, and they don't slow it down and try and save power when you switch to wave mode. I think that's what's happening. They just optimize the design around the highest processing requirement, which was the MP3.
See, now I was going to guess on the Tascam, which is only getting the 2 hour life, that they had internal algorithms based on, so maybe the wave doesn't have to have any algorithms applied to it, but if the MP3 algorithm had that, but I guess that doesn't really matter because the battery life was the same for both. So
Right.
Yeah,
well,
it's
effectively the same on the Zoom too. You know, 9.5, 10 hours. I think that's just the error in the measurement, really. Yeah. Almost. So.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, I think they haven't dropped the processor speed, because that's one of the things you can do in low power design.
Yeah.
Is,
or
if
you
you're not doing
too.
A lot of process, you can dynamically put them to sleep.
Yeah.
But because these things have to record all the time, pretty much.
Yeah.
Unless you're not recording, but when they're recording, they have to be processing full time, so you can't put them to sleep. But you can dynamically adjust the speed of the clock, of the processor clock. Usually, it depends on what sort of processor they're using in there. But all your modern, processors, your PIX and your Atmels and et cetera, most of them have dynamic clock switching. So so if you need to do like a little burst of high power processing, you don't. You don't just run your micro at the one high speed just because you might have to do a bit of processing every now and then.
Right.
You just switch the clock speed, go do your processing, then switch it back down again.
Yeah.
And that's how you can get good low power design. That's a starting point anyway.
Right.
And I don't think they're doing that in the Zoom H1.
Right. Oh, you're saying they're not doing that in the H1 or the Tascam?
I'm pretty sure they're not, because the Wave should be probably double the battery. Maybe not double, but at least more.
Right.
But it's actually the same or less.
Yeah, it's less intense. Yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah,
I'm sure that's what they're doing.
Maybe they're offloading, like you said, though. Maybe they're offloading for the MP3, and that's actually a lower power chip or something, too.
Maybe.
We won't know until we rip it open, and I'm not ripping mine open, so.
Right, well, I might take mine apart, but yeah, it depends on how easy it is to
right. Well,
rip
I'd
it
be
apart.
Remiss with that if I didn't mention the analog side of low power stuff. So obviously in the resting state, the quiescent current, and if listeners don't know what it took me a long time to ever figure out what the hell that was. And basically, that's a fancy word for resting current. So if it's just burning current without actually doing anything. So if you have an op amp and it's not actually amplifying anything, but it's just sitting there kind of at zero, it's burning some amount of quiescent current just to stay on. And you got to worry about that. But
And by the way, kiddies, that's a nice key word to throw in at job interviews, quiescent. It
quiescent,
sounds like
yes.
You know what you're talking about. You know, speak
Q-word,
in terms of DB and quiescent. So, exactly.
All right.
Scrabble
that's
score. That's pretty much it.
Just
so.
Try and string as many big $5 words together as you can.
That's it.
And you'll get the job.
Anyway, back to what you were saying.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, other things there, too. I mean, you could have a lot more of the chips now these days are lower power silicon processes, so they might be running off 2.5 rails instead of 5-volt rails, and then you'll have smaller drops internal to the chip, and then they'll actually need less active power as well. So they might only need 1 milliamp of current draw through an op amp versus 3 previously or something like that too. So that could be just we're 5 years down the track if the Tascam's that old, and that's just something the Zoom benefited from. But
yeah,
I find it hard to believe that there was they couldn't have found anything low power back then, but again, I didn't check when the Tascam TR-07 was made, so maybe I should check that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know why you'd market a product like that that's only got 2 hours battery. Are you sure these batteries weren't a Wan Hung Low brand Chinese thing? Were they good energizers or Duracell alkalines
sure they were,
or something?
Duracell, yeah.
Right. Oh, there you go.
It wasn't like super hot that day either. I mean, I know that you can get some better battery life out of cold batteries, but. Nope.
That's bizarre,
it's
really.
Because
why would you release a commercial product like, a recorder that only gets 2 hours from a set of double A's? That's just shit. I don't understand it.
I mean, I had one-off case. That's not a good test sample size, so that could have been it too.
Right.
I don't want to get yelled at by Tascam. I mean, but basically I am a very unhappy customer right now, to the point of taking it back, so. Sucks for them.
Well, there we... Yeah. Well,
that's all that matters.
Switch to Zoom, shall we?
Yeah.
So,
we'll see. I mean, I don't know. I'm sitting back down in my basement, so I'm not sitting in Boston in a hotel room in my skivs anymore. So, and not saying I was last time, but,
Right. Yes. Sure.
Yeah.
But low power design, that is quite an art, as we've always said, And if just something simple like you're powering a LED for your power indication or something like that, if you look at the traditional textbooks, they'll say run your LED at 20 milliamps. Well, that's just bullshit.
Yeah.
Guy can fly halfway to the moon on 20 milliamps. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So just, you know, you can, get you can up that resistor, run them at a couple of milliamps, get a high brightness version if you have to. If you're really designing a proper commercial product, it might where it's more important about the battery life is your prime requirement. You might spend a dollar for some super efficient LED, you know, because that you can run the damn thing at half a milliamp or something like that.
Yeah.
Some incredibly bright thing, but it costs you a dollar, but who cares, because your key requirement is your battery life.
Right, and that's those trade-offs we've talked about before.
And you can pulse the LED as well.
Oh, yeah, that's another good one.
So to get an average brightness over time. So
there's a lot of fun tricks about that.
And also, you know, if you're using a 10K pull-up, you know, everyone uses like a standard 10K pull-up. Well, you're pissing away current there too. Yeah. So, you know, up it to its maximum value, but watch your input leakage currents, kiddies.
Yep.
So you can't just up it to, you know, oh, let's up it to 10 meg or 100 meg or something.
Digital folk don't really care about leakage currents quite as much as the analog folk do, so that can burn you.
I wouldn't say that.
Well, it can burn you, though. You know, if you got some big leakage current then and your pull-up resistor isn't small enough, you know, then you'd be floating around a little bit and you could... That is not a fun thing to track down either, you know?
Like, oh, yeah.
Because then when you start touching things to the pins, you know, you start affecting the pins by probing them and your problem goes away and you're screwed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm just saying.
Now, well, that brings us on to babes, as everything does. Because
how does that bring us on to babes?
Everything does. You wanted to have a rant about the babes on the booths, the booth babes at trade shows.
Right.
Do tell.
Well,
what's the problem?
All right, here's the thing. Here's a question for you. If you're walking around a conference, and Dave, you said you've walked around conferences before.
Yep.
If you're walking around a conference and you see, you know, boring nerd in a booth, maybe they have cool products, you're boring nerd in a booth, and then you see, like, you know, someone
chicken hot pants. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to sound sexist here, because this is not a sexist comment, but, like, who's hiring these women? Like, what is the point here? And Dave, you said it works on you, but I immediately discount every product that does that. I'm like, really? Is your product that bad that you need to grab attention like that?
Oh, dude, you're thinking too much. Go for the hot women, okay?
It
works. It can be it's a valid marketing tactic. They know that 99% of people that come through are going to be, you know, male. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be nerdy, and they're going to like looking at hot chicks in hot pants, and it actually brings them in. And very few are going to think like you, well, I'm going to boycott your product because
I wouldn't call it boycotting. It's just healthy skepticism. I mean, like, come on, like, really? Like, all right, let's just remove the hot babes from the situation.
Right.
And excuse the babes if that offends you. But, I mean, even if you're giving away, I was once at a job fair. And they were giving away T-shirt. There was to individual people. They're giving away T-shirts, like 10 pens, like 2 throwy balls, like whatever. Like, it was like they were filling up like shopping bags of branded stuff for a programming company that I won't name here. The owner of it might be the mayor of New York, but and I was like, What are you doing here? If you need that much crap to sell your company on the auxiliary side of things, you know, if you're not saying you're gonna love working here, this should be enough. It's gonna be a prestigious job to work here. What are you doing? Why are you doing that? Sure, maybe you'll bring him in with a pen or whatever fun toy you want to have. But if you're going that over the top, I immediately discount you, just from the skeptical side of things.
So you're thinking too much. It's all about marketing. As much as I hate marketing, it does actually, a lot of it works. You could say most of it works. And the freebies get you in. You know, in some stands, freebies will always trump boobies, by the way, when it comes to nerd stalls, okay, at these trade shows. The guys will go after the... people will go after the freebies rather than the boobs, but the boobs help and the freebies help. They really do. You know, it's...
And there go all of our female listeners.
And there go all our female listeners. Sorry, female listeners, but you're a very small percentage. So as far as marketing's concerned, you don't exist.
Well,
so don't blame us. Blame marketing.
I hate it. I think that is so... I mean, part of me says, Dave, you're right. You know, like, so you see someone giving away, you know, even, like, someone's giving away a toy car, something stupid, right?
Yep.
And you're like, okay, I'd love to have a toy car. And it doesn't matter. It's just a matter of... get it grabbing attention. And that's, you're totally right about that. And it is a
exactly.
proven marketing technique, but I'm saying it doesn't work on Chris Gammel.
Right. There you go.
Did not like it. I thought it was underhanded and low. And,
right.
Yeah. So take that.
Well, it works at a different level too, not just to get them into the booths, because a lot of nerds will be actually scared to go up and talk to the booth, but these hot booth babes, right?
Yeah,
and get their stuff right. But they'll hang around the booth and they'll just like hang in a neighboring booth, but they'll be constantly watching the other stand, right?
Yeah.
Because there's hot women over there. So you're going to be looking at that stand and that just gets in your subconscious and you... stare at that stand for 10 minutes and you're going to go, oh, okay, even if I'm scared of the babes or I don't like the babes, I'm going to come back later.
Yeah,
because
or it's name
when they're not there,
even.
They're taking, or, you know, I'm going to check out their stuff because it's ingrained more in your subconscious. It's, you know.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I mean, even me.
More of your brand in your head.
Right, and I dislike them, but I remember their name because of it. There's a lot of booths there that I don't remember, but I remember their name. Now, I'm not going to say who it is because I'm not going to sink that low. I'm not giving them the benefit of being mentioned on a prestigious show like the Amp Hour. And that's right. I just called our show prestigious. But
it is prestigious.
I am not giving them that honor. So anyways.
Highly awarded.
I hope that you get to see lots of booth babes, Dave, but I don't need any of that.
Well, I don't need it either. It's just nice if it pops up, you know. Walk around the corner and there's these nice looking ladies, you know. What's wrong with that? Anyway.
I think we're
let's
out of
not
time.
Talk about that. Yeah. Speaking of...
no, Dave.
Are we out of time?
I think we're out of time, man.
Oh, bugger.
I think so.
Oh, come on. We have to at least talk about the Akihabara Electronics Market in Tokyo.
Right. You're
that
totally
is
right.
Awesomeness, right? That's pure awesomeness.
I wrote, holy crap,
we'll definitely
awesomeness.
Put up a link. Yeah, we'll put up a link to this. The Tokyo Hackerspace, some guy there who runs, I can't remember, some other blog, which is... Yeah. Anyway, he takes you on a guided video tour of the Akihabara. It's like 20 separate videos. Most of them are short.
Yeah,
but he takes you on
minutes.
A guided tour in Japan of all these electronics marketplaces, and they are
so
awesome.
Cool
picture, just DigiKey scattered among you know all these more than that, you know, you can get front
like,
panels manufactured there and walk in, and it's just
all the containers or the enclosures too. That was what he talked about a lot, and that was cool. And I've never been to one. I've read about the one in China. It was like Bunny something. I think it was named something Bunny, but
I've been to one in Singapore. Sim Ling Tower is the one in Singapore. I think there's another one too. There's one in Hong Kong, near Shenzhen somewhere. I can't pronounce.
Oh, that's the one I think
I'm
thinking of. It was in Shenzhen,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. There's Hong Kong. I've been to a similar one in Shanghai, but it's more computer consumer oriented. You had to go through like four different levels of consumer shit before you got to more of the hardware-y type
stuff.
And there wasn't as much as exactly. But the one in Singapore was exactly like this. So I just want to know at what point, and there are all these Asian countries, I've never heard of these style of marketplaces in other, you know, in other Western countries. I just haven't heard of it. So
I guess you can open one.
I don't know. What is the right here in Australia.
The manufacturing centralization there. I mean, it's not. I don't think it's a hobbyist thing. It's you're benefiting from it as a hobbyist, but it's definitely It's all in manufacturing. I mean, they even talked
about
because
all the parts come from there, and they're all surplus, right? There's 20 million.
Yeah,
you know,
and people know.
So everyone buys all these surplus bits, and they open up a stall.
Yeah, and probably cheap space too. It was interesting seeing some of those glass cases where they actually had people selling stuff personally, like a on-site eBay kind of thing. That was
different. It was an on-site eBay. Yeah, they had all these second-hand goods and all this test equipment that you could just.
Yeah.
There's a few in the US. There's a few of those surplus. Well, there's quite a few actually. There's surplus test equipment.
Yeah.
You know, places, but we're talking about like an entire shopping complex, like multi levels. You go up the escalators, and here's another 100 shops. You know,
yeah,
and they've all just got the parts and the anything you want.
I think the thing that would have to happen, you need like a really dense city center like they have there,
You do, like in Tokyo or in Shanghai or in Singapore, yeah.
And I was going to say that they would never be able to afford it in New York City, but then I think, well, Tokyo is not cheap on any scale either, so...
No, it's not, but they cram... If you've seen how small these stalls are, you almost can't walk in there because things are stacked up to the walls and
So awesome. The one with Transformers, there was an entire stand full of Transformers. I started drooling. I was like, oh, that's so cool. At first, I was like, Transformers, why is he showing more than meets the eye? And then I'm like, oh, those kind of Transformers, awesome.
It's great. Anyway, check it out. The link is there.
We'll put the link up.
And, fantastic. And that'll probably... do us for the day. I think we're out. We didn't get on to one or two things, but we'll carry them over to next time. So,
yep.
Wow, didn't that one fly by?
It did. Whew. Hopefully, we still have some female listeners and also some people that love open hardware that didn't like us talking about closed hardware. But hopefully, everybody's still listening.
Well, don't turn up to the Open Source Hardware Summit with your bloody iPhone, people. For goodness sake.
Well, anyway, I don't think there's open hardware phones yet, but we'll see. We'll see.
And, isn't the Android? But software's open.
Yeah, Bug Labs just released something today as one last final note. They just released something where the Bug Labs is a modular thing, and you can talk to Verizon's network now. They have a development tool.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so we might see that in the future.
The revolution is starting. All right, thanks, guys. Thanks for joining us. It's been a good one.
We'll talk to you soon.
And we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
See ya. Woohoo!
Yay, 10. We didn't even mention it was number 10. 10th show, man. That's crazy.